Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Massoud. Special thanks to Miriam Barnard, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 5 o'clock. So we've got
roasting 200 years of corporate constitutional rights, 1819 to 2019, notes the anniversary of the first U.S. Supreme Court decision granting constitutional rights to business corporations. The event features a photography exhibit, trivia, conversation, and presentations about how we can reclaim people's constitutional rights and dismantle corporate rights. Again, that's Roasting 200 Years of Corporate Constitutional Rights on Thursday, February 28th. From 6 to 9 p.m. This is a drop-in event happening at the Just Bob Cafe, 2403 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tonight the news is taking a break. Instead, we have a special program. We'll return to regular programming on Monday. Next, we're going to have Deep Dive Radio with Nick Espinoza asking, would you give your government the ability to take your DNA, enter it into a database, and let them search it at will to possibly connect you to a crime? In the USA, many privacy advocates are saying a new DNA law just enacted does exactly this.
And welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related. And I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin. And we've got a great show for you this half hour. We're going to be diving into some of the news on some very serious topics that are going on around the world and in our country. Our deep dive is going to be on DNA and privacy and why privacy is essentially becoming an illusion, but what we can do to combat this, what we can do to fix this, because I don't think a lot of people really understand DNA privacy and the ramifications of this. So it's going to be a fascinating half hour. I cannot wait to dive in. And as always, we're going to start with the news. And in 5G news, and I think this is really interesting. If you're not familiar, most of us that have cell phones out there are on 4G, or specifically 4G LTE. And 5G, and I've mentioned on the radio show, is the next push for the new infrastructure for super fast wireless. You know, it's going to solve, I think, a lot of different problems in this. But here's the thing. If you're an AT&T customer, you might have, and you might look on your phone, and your phone might say, instead of 4G, it might say 5GE. Now, this is something that AT&T has rolled out, I think, mostly nationwide, and 5G really isn't available, the actual 5G. So if I'm looking at Verizon, for example, I think they have five cities right now where they're piloting it in, where you can actually get 5G devices. And so if you're an AT&T customer, you see this and you think, oh, sweet, I just got upgraded to 5G and I didn't have to do anything. You may not necessarily know that in order to get 5G, you actually have to have equipment, meaning a cell phone or device, that is capable of accepting a 5G connection. So for example, I have a very new or very recent Android phone. It is 4G LTE. It does not have the hardware in it to accept a 5G connection. And so when I'm going to Verizon, for example, and wanting 5G, I have to get a new phone. And so you've got millions of AT&T customers out there that see 5GE and think, sweet, we're good. Not a problem. I'm on 5G, even though your phone can't actually take the technology. Now, this isn't the first time that AT&T has done this. When they were upgrading their 3G networks to 4G LTE, they started swapping people over with the symbol saying they're on 4G. And I can't remember if they did 4GE or they just said 4G. And AT&T has basically come out and said, our customers love it. They know we're getting ready for this. And basically they're saying we're just doubling the speed of our 4G network. And so they're enjoying a faster experience right now as we roll out our 5G. But a lot of people are confusing them or blaming them rather for deceptive practices. And Sprint went ahead and decided to sue them for this, basically saying you're giving false information that would, you know, people would kind of look at Sprint because we might have 5G faster than AT&T, but now they see 5G on their phone and they think we're good, no problem, and here we are. And so you tell me, is that a deceptive practice on AT&T's part, or is this just pure marketing and, you know, consumers should know better? Take it for what it's worth. I personally think it's a deceptive practice. I would rather know I'm on 4G with faster speed, like 4G times 2, 4G X2, something like that, as opposed to 5GE. But that is your AT&T slash, I guess, deceptive practices, you know, of news of the week, assuming you think it's deceptive practices. And in profit-sharing news, and I think you guys are going to find this one interesting because this involves Google, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Now, we all know that if we're signed up for Facebook, Google, et cetera, they make their money primarily through advertising. They data mine the ever-living heck out of you in exchange for you using their free and very convenient services like social media platforms or free operating systems for our phones, et cetera, et cetera. But they take that data, they sell it to advertisers. Now, a question has been arise, and it's actually, I've never really seen this before, and it's coming out of the state of California. And so recently they had their state of the state, which is California's State of the Union address, and their governor basically said that he would like to create a profit-sharing system so that any Californian that, let's say, you know, is using Facebook, we'll just use Facebook as an example, when Facebook sells their data to a third-party advertiser, they should get a cut of the profit. So in other words, if they sell, you know, Facebook, if Facebook sells your data to an advertiser for $10, you'll get a dollar. You know, whatever that is, there was no real specifics, but I thought that was very interesting. In part because they have monetized who we are. They have monetized our data, they being the Facebooks, Googles, et cetera, of the world, and they are actually selling it. And so should we get a cut of that since it's our personal data that we are generating every time we post, like, share, check in, et cetera? You know, or do we already have a viable exchange of goods? We understand that we get to use things like social media that connects us with everybody, or Google products that gives us free email, a free phone operating system, free GPS, free access to maps, et cetera, in exchange for this. And so California is taking it one step further than I've ever seen it take before. And I thought it was interesting because I don't necessarily know if this is the way, you know, we should be going in the world, but California seems to be going this way. California, interestingly enough, is also trying to put in their own advanced privacy protection that has essentially Silicon Valley freaking out because they don't want to deal with 50 independent states in the United States all saying, well, we're going to do our own privacy thing and you have to adhere to 50 different standards. They'd like a national one, probably one that they can lobby for and water down, but we will see where that goes. But back to the original point, should you be profit sharing with those companies that you're using their free services for as they data mine you? And I think a lot of people aren't necessarily aware that they're being data mined to the nth degree, as I've talked about over and over and over here on the radio show and on my videos and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, let me know. I think that's an interesting concept. And, you know, if that does come to fruition, you might be able to make a little bit of cash every time one of these companies makes a little bit of cash too. So take that for what it's worth. And in Cold War news, and yes, there is actually news on the Cold War, we may be entering a second Cold War. And I'm probably sure I'm going to do a deep dive on this, in the future. But Basically, Chinese state media is saying because the United States has started a initiative at the government level, basically signed into law by bipartisan Congress, Senate, and President Trump on AI, basically investing in developing advanced AI, China is basically saying this could be a Cold War, that we are resurging. Their state media, the Global Times, is reporting that, you know, well, you know, they're investing heavily in this, which means they might be making things like better weapons, you know, more smarter weapons, smarter hacking utilities, et cetera, which the Chinese sees, one, as a threat to their national sovereignty, but two, gives them the ability to, you know, gives them the ability to escalate in this war. Now, what's interesting about this is that prior to the United States enacting this law and then investing heavily in artificial intelligence creation, the Chinese have been doing it, and so have the Russians, and so have a whole bunch of others. And so we actually, if you're looking at this, are potentially, we being the United States, are potentially late to this game when compared to the Chinese and the Russians. And so, if anything, us entering this frame, while they're seeing it possibly as an escalation, I think may mean, in some cases, if you're looking at it, that we have to play some catch up here. And so it's a very interesting position that the you know, that the Chinese have come out with to say this, but literally they are basically signaling the fact that we might be in an arms race, quote unquote, an artificial intelligence arms race, which means we are officially in a Cold War because we're obviously not actively shooting at each other, and I hope it never comes to that. So here we go. We'll see where that goes, but we may be in a Cold War, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on that one. And now for the deep dive segment, where we take a closer and deeper look at a cybersecurity, cyber warfare, or technology issue around us. And if you have any suggestions for a deep dive segment or something you'd like me to dive into, you can once again find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick A. ESP. Again, that's Nick A. ESP. Or you can send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. That's questions@securityfanatics.com. I am more than happy to take a look at it. And if it meets our standards, we are more than happy to do a deep dive on it. So let's begin. And this deep dive is slightly a revisit from a previous deep dive. Now, I've done DNA and privacy on the radio show before, but we've had significant updates in this that, quite frankly, we didn't see coming necessarily, or if we did, it was flying under the radar and it pretty much escaped everybody's grasp. But we have some serious problems going on. So with that, I'd like to start, and we're gonna be talking first about CODIS. That's CODIS. If you're not familiar with this, this is actually a national database that federal law enforcement like the FBI uses to essentially track criminals. So for example, let's say the FBI gets called into a serial killer. They're going to take, let's say, possible suspect DNA. They're going to upload it into CODIS, and then they're going to try to get a match on that individual, or at least store that as they then gather suspects and compare it against the DNA at the scene of the crime, etc. Now, this process for CODIS actually has taken a couple of weeks. So let's say they get a suspect's DNA, they go ahead and they upload it to CODIS, and about 2-3 weeks later or so, they get results. This has been considered essentially too slow. What if you are tracking a serial killer and you think you've got the suspect, but it's going to take you 2 weeks to verify the DNA, and what do you do? Let that person go to kill again, etc. So this was the impetus for what was the Rapid DNA Act. Now, this was signed into law by President Trump in 2017. And basically, this is what it does. It allows the FBI, the federal law enforcement, to basically run DNA results and get them back from CODIS in less than 90 minutes. And so that is an obvious benefit to law enforcement in the sense that, well, if they have a suspect, you know, here we go. We can in 90 minutes know, and that obviously, you know, definitely helps them. This was actually passed by a bipartisan Congress. And so U.S. Congress, Democrats and Republicans voted for this. In the Senate, Democrats and Republicans voted for this as well. And so this was essentially unanimous on both sides that, yes, we are all for this. But here's the thing. The legislation also asks the Federal Bureau of Investigation to issue standards and procedures for use of rapid DNA technology so the fully automated process can be used virtually anywhere. Any criminal justice agency across the United States can collect swabs, upload the DNA samples to CODIS, and then get results on that. And so instead of being a federal database, what you have is a ton of local law enforcement being able to collect information on you, upload it to the database, and then get results on you, or compare it to other results that they have. And so what this has basically turned CODIS into is a national DNA database registry. And some people have issues with this. So if we are looking at groups like the Innocence Project or the Rutherford Institute, which is a civil liberties, basically they're like an ACLU, they have some problems with this. And reports have mentioned that this means the police can routinely take DNA samples from people who are arrested from a crime but not yet convicted of a crime, and that's a serious problem for the Innocence Project as well as the Rutherford Institute. Now, John Whitehead from the Rutherford Institute took it one step further, and I'm going to quote him here because I think he sums up their position rather nicely. And I quote, "We could look at a situation in which somebody could be arrested, have their mouth swabbed, and then be charged within hours after generating a DNA profile. We are looking at the erosion of the concept of innocent before proven guilty because it will allow police to go on fishing expeditions. When you sit on a park bench, you shed DNA. This is now up for grabs by police who could swab it and run it through a DNA database. If they find a match or if misconduct occurred anywhere in the vicinity where your DNA was found, you might find yourself charged with a crime you never committed merely because you happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Even people who aren't charged with major crimes could have their DNA put on file. People who are just seen as suspicious could have their genetic makeup stored in a criminal database, and we're also giving out that information, to third parties as well. And so that is a big problem, that we have. And so let's say I live in an urban area. I spend a lot of time in downtown Chicago, which means if I'm, let's say, at a restaurant with my family, or I'm visiting clients or a museum, or, just going to the park, whatever I'm doing, I'm leaving DNA places. And if a crime happens to occur, which, okay, it's Chicago, so we know that's going to happen. What if my DNA is one of those things that is in there? That is in the vicinity, that is swabbed, and now I am a suspect because I have been there. That's a major problem. And on top of all of this, now having local law enforcement basically creating this DNA database, on top of it, we have millions of Americans that have been routinely giving away their DNA to groups like 23andMe, MyHeritage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And before I dive into some of those, we know that if we have 2%, a DNA profile on exactly 2% of the global population, we have a DNA profile on the entire population of the planet. The reason being is that we're all genetically related. I mean, going back far enough, half of you listening here we probably have some kind of cousin, in relation to each other. And if we go back far enough, all of us do. And so when we're looking at this, we can find people and narrow people down, through their cousins, through their relatives. And one of those ones is the Golden State Killer. Now, if you recall, in 2000, I believe it was 18, might have been 17, the police basically decided to run the cold case of the Golden State Killer and take DNA samples that were collected at the crime scene and run them through a public database. This is a research database that many people have willingly uploaded their DNA information to, and they got a hit. They didn't find the Golden State Killer. They found relatives of the Golden State Killer, which then narrowed the suspect list down to exactly that person. They caught him, obviously, by virtue of that, and were able to convict him, of that crime, several years later. And so we see the power that DNA has through our relatives. And so you don't have to sit for a DNA test, but if you've got a cousin out there, or a sibling, or a mother, or a father, or aunt, uncle, second cousin, etc., they're now narrowing down the suspect pool simply because of that. And so privacy is a very difficult thing when we're talking about DNA. And on top of that, as we are willingly giving away our DNA to third-party companies, as millions have done to 23andMe, Family Tree DNA, MyHeritage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we start to see problems crop up. And it's in part law enforcement, in part cybersecurity, in part major corporations. And as we go through this, take a look at the list. So 23andMe partnered up with one of their major investors, which happened to be GlaxoSmithKline, that essentially invested hundreds of millions of dollars into 23andMe, and they are now taking the DNA profile submitted to 23andMe for advanced genetic research. Now, that's obviously in some aspects a good thing. If they're able to, let's say, find a cure for cancer, nobody's really complaining about that. But how they handle that data, how they treat that data, you know, which is essentially 100% unique and personal to anybody that has submitted DNA information to 23andMe, that's a serious problem. We also learned about Family Tree DNA on February 4th of this year. It was publicly understood, and they apologized for this, that they were sharing DNA with the FBI because the FBI was looking for murderers, violent criminals, all this kind of stuff. And so they would give a DNA profile and say, oh, are you Bob Smith? Bob Smith. Here's Bob Smith, and here's Bob Smith's DNA. FBI, have at it. Take a look. And so from the New York Times, the article that essentially broke this, I quote, unbeknownst to its users, the Houston-based firm quietly and voluntarily agreed in 2018 to open its database of more than 2 million records to the FBI and examine DNA samples in its laboratory to identify suspects and victims of unsolved rapes and murders. And so while that may, let's say, be a noble cause, I mean, I think every murderer and rapist should be caught, what else does this open it up to? And, you know, maybe you're not. Maybe you have some DNA profile and it's not you. It's a cousin. It's a relative. I mean, we have a lot of different issues with this. And when we're looking at this, one of the other things that we're looking at is, you know, how do we lock this down? At the end of the day, we have, let's say, a massive federal law enforcement that now includes local law enforcement DNA database called CODIS. We've got 23andMe. We've got Family Tree DNA. We've got MyHeritage DNA, which essentially was a massive cybersecurity breach, and over 90 million records from MyHeritage DNA were stolen by hackers, and dumped onto the dark web. And so we are trusting these organizations. We're also trusting law enforcement, whether it's with our cybersecurity that they're going to maintain good standards, whether it's with our privacy rights that they are, you know, only going to use the DNA for good and not actually catalog the DNA, et cetera, which is a serious concern for groups like the Innocent Project, the Rutherford Institute, and privacy advocates everywhere. But we are sitting on this, and there seems to be no recourse. So I will give you a perfect example, like of myself. I have not taken a DNA test. I have not gone to 23andMe, et cetera, and, you know, submitted DNA to that. I have also not been a suspect, as far as I know, you know, in some kind of federal, state, or local crime. And so I've never had my DNA taken, by any kind of law enforcement. And so I don't know if any of my relatives have. I might have a cousin out there, you know, that has done that, that has submitted those samples to one of these companies. And by virtue of that, I am now, at least in part, in a database identified by who I am related to. And so if I want total privacy from these third-party corporations, as well as, let's say, my government, I now really don't have that ability because my relatives, who, let's say, have a different view on this or simply just didn't understand the ramifications and implications of this, decided, well, I'm going to do this. I'd like to learn who my, you know, far distant relatives are, et cetera, and here we go. And so what does that look like? What does the future look like when we are talking about DNA privacy in the future? You know, we need to understand, how we can either combat this, secure this, make this private, et cetera. And right now there are essentially two schools of thought on this. First, we legislate through government a very stringent DNA privacy law, something like what the GDPR is in Europe. And if you're not familiar with the GDPR, and I know I've mentioned it here on the air before, it's essentially this. The GDPR is a general data protection rule for consumers and citizens of the European Union against companies like Facebook, Google, and others that data mine them. As an EU citizen, you have the right to go to, let's say, Facebook, for example, and say, I want to know everything you have on me. You know, what data do you have on me? How have you used it? Who have you sold it to? And I want you to formally and completely erase me from this, or allow or block, you know, whatever advertising they want to do to you. That was a major shift for privacy rights in the European Union, and we don't have anything like that here in the United States. And so if we were to legislate something like that, that would give us the ability to go to a 23andMe, a MyHeritage, the FBI, whatever, and say, what DNA do you have on me? What are you doing with it? How has it been used? And I want my DNA erased permanently from any of these databases. That obviously becomes a significant problem and an issue, especially when you have cousins involved, because let's say your cousin doesn't want his or her, you know, data erased because they simply don't care or don't understand or, you know, whatever their logic or reasoning is, you know, and that's fine. And we can look at examples of where we open up cans of worms in this. So I did audio on my daily podcast and video on my daily videos of a woman that had a 5-year-old daughter that she had conceived through a donation from a sperm bank. And so when her daughter was 5, she put her daughter's DNA up on 23andMe. And the goal there was not to find relatives. The goal was to say, okay, I want to understand what my daughter may be susceptible future in life. Does she have a possible problem with cancer or dementia, et cetera, et cetera? But 23andMe, being kind of social networking on top of this, as they all are, these third-party companies, linked her to the sperm donor, linked her to the father, the actual biological father, who obviously wants nothing to do, you know, with this child because, again, he's a sperm donor. And so she basically reached out, and then she got slapped down by the adoption agency saying you can't do that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so how do we legislate that? And what does that look like? How do we create a privacy law that, let's say, protects me if I was a sperm donor, and I'm not, but let's say I was, how can I go on to 23andMe to get my information, but say, yeah, you know, I want to be linked to my relatives, but don't link me to any of the children I possibly fathered by virtue of my donations who, you know, I don't know how many there are out there. I don't know if they exist or whatever, but if they do, don't link that. I mean, do you get what I'm saying here? I mean, this is a serious can of worms that we are opening up, and we don't have answers for these things, which makes it interesting because the literal other side of the coin, the other side of the equation here is there are advocates that say, you know what, there's nothing to hide. Let's take everybody, let's create a national genetic database and take every single U.S. citizen, for example, and put them in this database and make it 100% open and 100% public so that anybody can do it. And if it's 100% in the light of day, then no harm can come to you by virtue of this. Now, I tend to disagree with this primarily because if we're looking at the last case of, you know, the donor father, I mean, that's one of those things where now what? You can look up your donor father. You can look up, you know, who you were adopted if they want to remain anonymous. I think that's, you know, one of those rights that, you know, that they should probably have. Otherwise, you know, then who would go ahead and willingly donate to something like a sperm bank, et cetera? Or, you know, if we're doing this, then, you know, let me put it this way. I'm trying to think of the words. We don't know when the next innovation in technology or privacy or workaround or hacking or ransom or, you know, good, bad, and ugly is going to show up. And so when we can think of every possible avenue for how we could, let's say, use DNA against us in some, you know, malevolent way, somebody's going to find a new way. And so when we think we've covered all bases, a new base is going to pop up and somebody's going to use it. And everybody's going to say, oh God, you know, that ship has sailed. There's nothing we can do about it. Now we have to legislate, you know, figure out how to protect this, et cetera. But it's out there. And so I don't necessarily know if that's the right way to go. I mean, obviously, you tell me. I'd love to hear from you on that, as I love to hear from all my listeners. But that's a serious problem. And I think as we're looking at this, there's no easy answers to this situation. But when we have law enforcement literally saying, okay, every local law enforcement in every town, every community can now use this database, and we're going to build a massive national database, and you don't necessarily have to be a suspect, like the Rutherford Institute said. You can literally just be sitting on a park bench, you know, the day before a violent murder happens, and now your DNA is mixed up, and they're going to take that, catalog that, and make you a suspect. I think that's a serious problem, and I don't think there are any easy answers here. You know, and as we're looking at this, I mean, all of these developments have literally just hit recently. So the rapid DNA thing was enacted in 2017, but it didn't come to fruition until 2019, because obviously they needed time to ensure that the processes and procedures would be in place. So when they did turn it live, you know, it would run smoothly, which obviously from a process standpoint makes sense. And so let me know what you think on this, but I think that's a serious problem that we are going to be running into perpetually here in the United States. And how do we legislate it? How do we protect it? Do we not protect it? Do we open it up to everybody else? I think there are so many different avenues here for that, and it's a serious problem that we have to combat, address, look at, realize this is an issue. And I think a lot of people are just simply not aware of the privacy complications they add to their lives by using third parties like 23andMe and MyHeritage DNA. And so, you know, here we go. And, you know, take it for what it's worth. But that is your deep dive of the week. I hope you guys enjoyed it. And with that, we'll keep moving on. And thank you so much for tuning in this week. It was another fun show, and I think we covered a lot of really good stuff. And I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. It was a really good time. And I hope you keep tuning in. Thank you very much for listening to the Deep Dive Radio Show here with Nick Espinoza. And if you have any comments, suggestions, questions, absolutely anything, once again, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. And you can always send an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. Don't be shy. I love the feedback. We've been having a great time with the show. And as always, stay safe and stay online, everyone. Thanks for listening.
And you're listening to KBOO Portland. That was just a special broadcast of Deep Dive. Back to regular programming next week. And coming up, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, corporate media aren't in the business of challenging the idea that corporations are benevolent social actors who bring benefits to the communities lucky enough to have them. So even if Amazon didn't own a major newspaper, there was no reason to expect much by way of